With that, let's turn to the precious metals market report. Franklin, are you with us?
Right here.
Okay, so before I bring you in, I just want to mention two things. One is I just came last weekend from Easter weekend with Franklin at his church in Tennessee, in West Point, Tennessee. And I have to tell you, Franklin, it was one of the most inspiring, reviving series of services and sermons that I've ever been a part of. I feel completely renewed. And the other thing I have to mention is it's your wife's birthday today.
That's correct.
So you are an incredibly busy man, because I know you worked all weekend, and it's Susan's birthday, so I can't thank you enough for coming in and doing the Precious Metals Market Report tonight.
Well, I'm glad to do it.
Okay, so bring us up to date on the markets. What's been going on since last month?
Well, I was expecting silver and gold to bottom sometime around the end of March, or to prove that they'd made a bottom by the end of March. And they've pretty well done that. In 5 days, gold has vaulted from 1608 to nearly 1680 today, 1679.50, which is through three resistance areas, bumping on the top of real strong resistance where there's a cluster of moving averages right above where gold is, plus the lateral resistance at 1682 or so. And so they both advanced really well. Silver's added, since Monday, has added $1.50. Hasn't really, neither one of them have definitively confirmed that they're not going to do any more work to the downside. But, you know, you don't get confirmation until considerably after the bottom's been made. So if you wait till you get confirmation, then you'll be buying it at $1,800 instead of $1,680. So what we can look for is, if gold gets through this area and the top of the area is about 1705, then very, very quickly gold could move to $1,750, even $1,800. And that'll, in my mind, that will completely confirm that we've seen the lows, everything's been done. With silver, I'm waiting for it to get over the 300-day moving average, and when that happens, that's the end of it. You've seen the last of any kind of correction. But part of this, of course, is subject to what's happening with the dollar. The Fed is, Steve Saville says that the Fed's job is not to manage the currency. The Fed's job is to manage inflation expectations. That is, we know the Fed's always going to inflate. That's the only thing they can do. That's what they're set up to do. So what they have to do is to manage the expectations of more inflation so that not everybody catches on and says, hey, they're inflating the dollar, I'm going to get out of it. And Bernanke's done a good job about that. He keeps the markets off balance. He keeps them wondering whether he's going to put out more money or not, going to print more money or not print more money. Oh, yes, we're going to keep the interest rates low. Well, they can't keep the interest rates low over time without printing more money. They're just, there's no way they can do that. I know what he's going to do. I don't know why other people don't. But there was the markets reached a kind of a stalemate, which broke earlier this week when the stock market broke down through the 13,000 level, and the S&P the Dow broke through the 13,000, the S&P broke through 1,400, and there's a possibility that this may not be the end of that stock market move. We may see one more move to, 13,250, or maybe even higher than that, but it's pretty much the end of it, and I think of course, you're entering a time of year after you get through May when silver and gold go a little bit dead. But I'm feeling very, very good about my prediction that gold will go to 2260 this year and carry silver right along with it. And, of course, when silver gets through $50, then it'll be Katie bar the door. It'll jump really fast after that. So we've been through a long time. Maybe the correction's not over yet, but if you think about it, silver's been correcting for about nearly a year, and gold has been correcting since that high in early in September, and since the fall at the end of September. So that's, you know, that's about the number of months that you'd expect. It might go on a little longer, and we may get some sideways trading here, you know, all the way up into August or September. But we've seen the worst.
If you could just say a little bit about the seasonality of the markets.
Well, you have a strong tendency in gold to peak in the first 5 months of the year, April, May, June, or April, May, sometimes February. And very, very seldom do you get highs in June, July, and the first part of August. Often you get lows, significant lows in August, not necessarily the lows for the year, but significant lows. But generally speaking, what happens is that the market goes a little bit lower or flat across June and July, and then about the end of July starts to perk up a little bit and then really starts moving in September. And then you get peaks often in August, and you generally get higher prices in December.
Well, it's going to be interesting this year because when we come into September and October, they're going to have to redo the new budget. And if I'm right that the campaign's going to get dirty, it could be an extraordinarily tense time. So,
I think you're watching the effect of the election already, because all the talk about the jobs situation getting better and this, that, and the other, you know, they change those, they manipulate those figures. They do that anyway, but they certainly do that in the election cycle and as you go into the election. So that, you know, that casts a lot of question in the minds of investors who are not, most investors don't get the very first principle of investing, which is always go with the primary trend. And so they're hot today, they're cold tomorrow, they're hot, they're cold, and all they do is get whipsawed from one thing to the other.
Right. Well, let's. I'd like you to just introduce our topic. We're talking tonight about why invest in a managed market. And before we bring Chris Palin, I just wanted maybe if you could give everybody your why invest in a managed market in a nutshell speech.
Well, you know what the way I think about it is this way: if there's a knife fight going on, and you're trying to make a bet, trying to decide which of the two fellas you want to bet on, and there's a little bitty skinny guy with a pen knife, and there's a great big well-muscled, flexible, quick fellow with a 24-inch Bowie knife, who are you going to back? And when I look at the Federal Reserve against the economy, I know who to back. The Federal Reserve is not going to win. They're going to keep on inflating. That's what drives a gold market, and I have to bet on the biggest player. What they do is they manipulate markets at the margin. They can't throw the whole market because the weight of it is too great, so they can manipulate it for a few days in one direction or another, and they might manipulate it for longer. They might, depending on the weakness of the market at the time, and if they're very, very good about the times that they pick to strike the market, like when it's already overextended and they go in and sell a bunch, then that will have a bigger effect than at a time when the market's in the middle of a very strong upward surge. So they manage at the margin, but they can't manage the primary trend. They can't make gold and silver go around and go turn around and go back down. They can do that for a day or two at the margin, maybe a month, maybe 2 months, but eventually the huge, enormous weight of the whole creature, not just the margin, is going to overwhelm them. And my argument for that is very simply, if they are able to stop the market, then why has gold gone in 11 years from $252 to $1,680 today, and silver gone from $4 to $32.50? I mean, if that's controlling a market, they're not controlling it very well. So I think the only sensible strategy for investing is to go with what's going to get better. You know, go with what has all the fundamental forces working in its favor. And as long as we have the governmental and central bank set up that we have, they're going to keep inflating. over the years, they've built in over the, you know, it's 100 years next year since we've had the Federal Reserve. And over that 100 years, they have misdirected money and capital in the economy. And in the last 20 years, they've created an enormous bubble of bad debt and malinvestment. And that drags down the economy. In addition to that, they keep companies with political connections alive that ought to be sent to the junk heap. So all of that has created such a drag on the economy that it can't be overcome. Not by all the key.
Well, I would say it differently. I would say that they've harvested the economy for a great deal of money and resources, and it's been quite successful, Franklin, for what it was created to do.
Well, if you want to look at it that way, that's true. But but what it was created to do was not to make an efficient economy that creates prosperity for everyone. It can't do.
Well, I would say it this way, because right now all markets are managed, no matter what you're investing in. And, of course, my goal is to make sure that they can't manage my mind and everybody else who's listening to us today. But to me, you can put money in paper that finances that fellow to own and control real things. Or you can own and control real things, whether you're owning them yourself, as in your house and land, or your car, or, you know, other tangibles like your coins, or your, you know, whether you buy it in the stock market or you buy it, you know, in a depository and put it there. But is it tangible? Are you financing the means of production, or are you giving somebody else the, you know, the ability to finance it at your expense?
Well, is it going into production or speculation?
Right.
The
reality is the manipulation of price. You know, there's a difference between the real price and the manipulated price, and that is constantly tricking people out of owning, you know, or controlling more directly into financing somebody else to own and control.
Right.
So the reason you want to invest in a managed market is you don't want to end up financing the other fellow controlling. Anyway, so with that, let me bring in Chris and just introduce him first. Chris is the editor of a newspaper in Connecticut. I first met him, I think, in 2000. He is an unbelievably astute and seasoned journalist, very experienced, very knowledgeable. He started the Gold Antitrust Action Group with Bill Murphy long ago. That's how I met him. And I must say that Chris has been the leader of documenting and of publishing and republishing all the evidence as to the interventions and management in the precious metals market. And by so doing and bringing transparency to that, he and his colleagues at GATA have done an enormous service in helping people understand what's going on and how to protect themselves from debasement. Just in my life, I know thousands of people who literally, thanks to Chris and Bill and their efforts, have been investing in precious metals. And it's worked, as Franklin said, that if you look at what's happened to the prices, they have been able to protect themselves from debasement thanks to their effort, to Chris and his colleagues' efforts. So Chris has been tireless, not only having a full-time job as an editor, but also speaking around the world on these issues, both radio and at events, and running what's called the GATA Wire. If you go to GATA.org, you can sign up for his news service. It's very well done. And always, occasionally, you'll get some pretty funny and acerbic commentaries from Chris. Chris always sets me out to laughing. So it's a pleasure to have him with you. Are you with us, Chris?
Catherine, delighted to be here. Thank you. And hello, Franklin.
Hey there. How are you?
Well, I posted some of your many compendiums or sort of collections of all the evidence. But maybe if you could just walk us through how you got involved in bringing transparency to the precious metals markets, and then what you feel is some of the best evidence that has been collected and put forward on what's been happening in the gold and silver markets.
Well, I got involved in the gold market simply by accident, Kath, I guess, back in 98, 99. I was casting about for contrarian investment opportunities, and I think I responded to an ad in the Wall Street Journal or some other paper where you sent them 10 or 20 bucks and they gave you free 2-month subscriptions to various newsletters, and one of the ones I received was Jim Blanchard's Gold newsletter, which Brian London is writing now that Blanchard's no longer with us. And Blanchard, this is, you know, back in 98, 99, was saying the gold seemed awfully low, and I had heard somebody say buy low and sell high, so I started following the gold market. I very quickly ran into Bill Murphy's internet site of financial commentary, lametropolecafe.com, and that was concentrating on the gold and silver markets. Bill's a former futures trader, and he began noticing patterns in those markets that suggested that the same big investment banks were intervening in the market to knock the prices down at crucial points, and he was complaining that this was market manipulation. And after a few weeks of his complaining about it, I got kind of sick of it, and I sent him an email saying that there was a lot of circumstantial evidence suggesting that he was correct, but if he was correct, what was happening was against the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act and 50 state antitrust acts, and that if somebody wanted to start a committee and hire a law firm to bring a class action lawsuit against the market manipulators and collect triple damages, I would be very happy to make a contribution. And Murphy thought it was a good idea, and that's how we founded GATA, and I think it was a year or two before we realized that the investment banks and the monetary metals markets were not really doing this on their own, that they were actually functioning as the agents of U.S. government policy. The purpose of this manipulation is simply to regulate, control, manipulate the currency markets, interest rates, really to support the dollar, or very possibly now to weaken it in a controlled way. There's a lot of academic documentation for gold's relationship to the value of currencies and particularly interest rates and the price of government bonds. There's a traditionally an inverse relationship between the price of gold and interest rates, and this is why governments always have intervened in the gold market. They used to do it openly. Now they do it largely surreptitiously, but not entirely surreptitiously. But they do it to control interest rates. They do it to control the value of their currencies. They do it to really support the price of their bonds. And now this intervention is so pervasive. It's gone so far beyond the monetary metals markets that it's just everywhere. You're talking about investing in a managed market. I don't think there's any substantial asset now whose price is not more controlled by government policy and market intervention than it is by actual market factors. In fact, I think in my little remarks to our conference in Washington 4 years ago this month, where I said that there were no markets anymore, just interventions. I began to say back then that because government intervention, largely surreptitious, is so pervasive now that we really don't know what the price of anything is anymore. Gold and silver are only, you know, a couple of elements in it. I don't think we know what the market price of toothpaste is.
Well, I put up your quote on the blog, and let me just read it. Since central bank intervention in the currency, bond, equities, and commodity markets has exploded over the last few years, we don't really know what the market price of anything is anymore. Thus, the gold suppression story is a story about the valuation of all capital and labor in the world and whether those values will be set openly in free markets the democratic way or secretly by governments the totalitarian way. I have to say that I would love for the Salier Report subscribers to understand the importance of an honest price, because what we're watching is tremendous misallocation of capital, and it's happening because people don't know what the price is.
And we're watching central banks destroying capitalism, really destroying free market economies that are largely responsible for mankind's progress. And the consequences of this are grave, to put it mildly.
Well, you said tonight when I emailed with you that you think the most important story is what you called financial repression. Maybe you could describe what you mean by that.
Yeah, this is a term that commentators and academics and even a recently resigned member of the Federal Reserve Board, Kevin Warsh, have begun using. And by financial repression, they mean in the immediate sense the use of government power to force people to buy government debt, which is paying a below inflation interest rate. The idea is to inflate government debt away without, you know, immediately catastrophic results, to do it gradually in a way that, you know, people are less likely to notice. It's you know, this misallocation of capital that you and Franklin were talking about. But I would extend financial repression to include a lot of other assets. This recently resigned member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, Kevin Warsh, a few months ago wrote an essay in the Wall Street Journal about financial repression. And he wrote that governments were trying to suppress prices they didn't like. And we didn't specify what the prices were, and I tried very hard to reach him and ask him, first, which prices particularly was he talking about? And secondly, did he learn of financial repression by virtue of his service on the Federal Reserve Board? And while I did reach him through the Hoover Institution, where he'd become a fellow, and I did get a cordial response from him, and he was very helpful to me and gaining me access to some remarks he was making at an event at Stanford a couple of weeks later. I could not engage him in the specifics, but you know, I think the remarkable thing here is a few months ago, a recent member of the Federal Reserve Board wrote an essay in the Wall Street Journal saying the governments were trying to suppress prices they didn't like. He did not specify those prices, and while the Financial Times took brief notice of his speech, and while the Wall Street Journal published it, and while I tried to engage several writers at the Wall Street Journal to pay some attention to it, to follow up and ask them which prices and how do you know, nobody picked up on it. Now, you know, this is like hiding in plain sight. You've got a member of the Federal Reserve Board just resigned, who says that the government is engaged in financial repression and suppressing certain prices the government doesn't like. And I cannot find one journalist in the world, including no journalists at the paper who published the essay, to ask them which prices and how do you know?
Well, it's like when $59 billion went missing from HUD the first year, I couldn't get anybody interested in it.
Yeah, well, I know why I can't get anybody interested, and at least nobody in the mainstream press. It's because the government and the mainstream press are not really distinct operations. I'm always teasing my partner, Bill Murphy, got his chairman, who is always sore that we have such trouble getting into the mainstream press, and I note that. You know, the Wall Street Journal, from page 2A back to page 24A, every page has got an ad from, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or, you know, Bank of America or Citigroup. And, you know, Bill wants to know why God is not on the cover of the B section.
Now, you continue to have a lawsuit with the Federal Reserve?
No, we've consulted to the national class action lawsuit against Morgan Chase for rigging the silver market, but we're not a plaintiff in that. Our most recent action was a federal Freedom of Information lawsuit against the Fed and U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and last year we won that case. We got a a court ruling that the Fed had withheld a lot of documents involving gold from us. The court ruled that most of those documents, really all but one of those documents, were properly withheld because there were exemptions, or at least claims of exemptions under the law, but the judge found that one particular document, the minutes of the G10 Gold and Foreign Exchange Committee meeting, I think from 1998, had been illegally withheld from us. And so on that basis, she ruled that we had won the case, ordered the Fed to disclose that document, and the Fed ended up having to pay us court costs of $2,800. And that check from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond to the Gold Antitrust Action Committee for $2,800 is proudly posted at our internet site. I waited the longest time before cashing that check. I thought that was a great trophy. And that lawsuit, I think, was successful for its success and successful for its failure. That is, the document that we did unearth from the Fed at court order showed the central bank and treasury officials from the G10 nations meeting secretly and discussing essentially rigging the gold price and coordinating their gold policies at a meeting that was never announced to the world. And the lawsuit was successful in its failure to unearth the remaining documents because at least we determined in a court judgment that the Fed has lots of gold records that it will not let the public see. And particularly in the Fed's internal adjudication of our request, we had our complaint got kicked upstairs to this same Fed board member, Kevin Warsh, who acting as a sort of hearing officer, decided which documents were going to be released to us, at least the Fed's volition, and decided that none of them were, but he identified in a letter to our lawyer, he specified some of the documents. And among the documents, the gold-related documents the Fed was concealing, Warsh wrote to our lawyer, and this letter is posted on our internet site, were records of gold swap arrangements between the Fed and foreign banks. So we have an admission on Fed stationery, signed by a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, that the Federal Reserve has secret gold swap arrangements with foreign banks, and that these gold swap arrangement records must remain secret, no matter the cost. The only purpose
admission
of these gold swap arrangements is for the Fed to intervene, or the U.S. government to intervene, surreptitiously in the gold market through intermediaries. This is public record.
I have always been amazed that they gave that to you.
I wonder now, given Warsh's essay in the Wall Street Journal and his gentle complaint about financial repression, in retrospect now, I wonder if he let that slip for a purpose. Originally, I thought, oh my God, he doesn't know what they've done here. He's given the game away. But then, 2 years later, he's writing this essay in the Wall Street Journal complaining about financial repression. Well, was he, trying to be a little bit more honest than the typical member of the Federal Reserve Board?
Yeah, they didn't have to give you that. I mean,
it was much more detailed than was necessary. He could have just written us a one-page letter telling us to go screw. They weren't going to give us a damn thing. But instead, he wrote us a three-page letter, which specified some of the material they were insisting on withholding from us. And, among that material were these gold swap records.
You've gotten some quite remarkable documents out of the government. And my favorite is the letter from the Treasury on confiscation. Perhaps you could share that story with us?
Oh, sure. I guess this is probably, 6 or 7 years
back.
Ago. But, it's still relevant. Confiscation, of course, is a great concern to any of us who were invested in the monetary metals. It happened once to a certain extent in the United States back in 1933. There's a lot of, rumor and speculation about the issue. I thought, well, let's, go to the source. That's what journalism is supposed to do. I wrote a letter to the Treasury Department, asking to know exactly what the Treasury Department's position on confiscation of monetary metals was. They did not answer me, and eventually I wrote to my Congress, John Larson, here in Connecticut, who's a Democrat I've known for many, many years, does very good constituent service, asking him for help in getting the Treasury to answer me. And once I had my congressman involved in badgering them, I did get a response, a very long and candid response from the guy who had recently taken over as the, I guess, the deputy assistant, secretary for foreign assets control. And this letter is posted on GATA's internet site and on our confiscation page, which you can find easily on the left side of our homepage as an entry for it. Confiscation. Anybody can read it, but it sets forth the, as best I can determine, the only official statement the government has made in recent years on the issue of confiscation. And the Treasury Department said that its position is this, that under the Emergency Economic Powers Act of, I think it's 1974, and the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, which is the act that Franklin Roosevelt purported to be using when he ordered the confiscation of U.S. monetary gold back in 1933, that under these two laws, the Treasury Department claims the power upon a proclamation of emergency by the President of the United States to seize or freeze any gold or silver or any gold or silver-related asset for, you know, national purposes. But then the Secretary for Foreign Assets Control told me in a very nice way that I shouldn't get too paranoid about it, because under the same two laws, upon proclamation of an emergency by the President, the Treasury Department claims the power to seize or freeze any financial asset owned by anybody, not just gold and silver, but anything you have. The government claims the power to seize or freeze upon proclamation of an emergency by the President.
So at least all your assets are standing in the same
basket. Yeah, that's, you know, so right. You know, it's what are they, you know, land of the free, home of the brave.
Well, let's go back to the topic that I started with this evening, and that is why invest in a managed market? Now, you presumably, I'm assuming, are still a gold investor. Why do you continue to invest in a managed market? What do you think the case is for doing so?
Well, you know, first I gotta, you know, confess I am not an investment advisor. I'm a mere citizen of the United States, and unfortunately, mere seems to be increasingly the operative word. But the advice I've been giving friends is to get, you know, all the gold and silver you can, real metal, not, you know, paper claims on it. And then find a safe planet to keep it on. And when you find that planet, please call me and tell me what it is so I can join you. There is immense political risk in investing in the monetary metals. On the other hand, given the pervasiveness of government intervention in the markets, managed markets, I think, is a very polite way of putting it, I cannot see saving in any instrument, any vehicle that is not you know, a hard asset, that is not, you know, something concrete you can hold in your hands. I am confident that if anything resembling a market system is ever restored, the price of gold and silver will be far higher than they are now, you know, relative to all other assets. Why do I think that? I think that because I am morally convinced that there is an enormous, virtually infinite, naked short position in both of the monetary metals. That is, I'd say the greater part, you know, probably 75, 80, 90% of the gold and silver the world thinks it has doesn't exist. There's just so many extra paper claims to metal that doesn't exist that if and when these naked short positions are discovered, and I think they are in the process of being discovered, there may not be enough zeros to put behind the gold and silver price. Now, that's a matter of great hope to me and other gold and silver investors. However, the question arises, when gold and silver are revalued, either by government policy or by the markets exploding upon the naked short positions discovery, will the government let us keep our metals? Will the government punitively tax our capital gains? I don't know. This issue is just fraught with political questions, hypotheticals. I don't know what's going to happen, but I am morally certain that there are enormous naked short positions in gold and silver, and that they are likely to be discovered in what remains of my lifetime. So while it's a risk in investing in them, I think it's probably less risky than investing in anything else. And I think that's the short answer to your question: why invest in a managed market?
When you have a breakdown in law and order, the question is. Is, as the IMF said, is anything safe? I think the part of, I would say the issue of the naked short in gold and silver is really a national security question because it's matched up with what I believe are the equivalent, I call them collateral fraud instead of naked short, that you have the same problem in the mortgage markets and in the government bond markets. So you have a real gap between the real stuff that exists versus what people think they hold.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this intervention that is going on, everywhere, and these, collateral frauds you're talking about, they are all part of the same thing. The government policy toward the financial markets now survives only insofar as it is able to deceive everybody. If that deception is exposed, the whole thing comes crashing down. And yes, indeed, I agree with you completely that. The gold and silver price suppression schemes are considered national security issues because if gold and silver, the monetary metals, ever begin trading freely and power devolves from the government to the people, the government is not going to like that very much.
No, they're not going to like tax collections very much. Let me ask you, Chris, you gave one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of what a radical debasement is, and maybe if you could describe what a radical debasement is and whether or not you think there's any possibility that such a thing could happen in the next couple of years.
Well, if gold and silver were revalued overnight, there'd be new values for everything, not just gold and silver. I might very much love, in theory, a gold price of $10,000 an ounce, but that will very likely bring the price of a Big Mac up to $50, $60,
right.
maybe more. I mean, but this is inevitably, I think, going to happen because of the distortions that the government has put into the markets for so long with its the interventions that. Franklin was talking about the disparagement we hear about gold particularly is that its price has not kept up with inflation, and so this is the sneer that's always made about gold. For some reason, nobody asks the follow-up question: well, if gold hasn't kept up with inflation over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, why is that? I mean, if oil has kept up with inflation, or bread has kept up with inflation, or real estate has kept up with inflation, why gold particularly has done so poorly relative to the debasement of the currency? The answer is obvious. It's because the Western central banks have created this naked short position in gold by this inflation of the imaginary gold supply. The gold paper that has been created is what is suppressing the gold price. You know, we don't just have to dig gold out of the ground to think we have gold now. The governments can underwrite through the bullion banks, the investment banks, the issuance of virtually infinite gold paper. And as long as people accept that paper, as long as people who think they're buying gold do not take the metal in possession from Franklin's shop or somebody else's shop and take it out of the banking system, then the Western central banks can create imaginary gold in infinite quantities and forestall the recognition of the inflation that they've created over the many decades. The whole game here has been to divert the monetary inflation away from investment in real things whose rising price would show up very directly in consumer price indexes, and to divert that inflation, that surplus money supply, into mere paper claims on real things. The British economist Peter Warburton, I think, was the first one I know of anyway who figured this out. He wrote an essay back in 2000 or 2001, which is also posted on Gonda's internet site, called "The Debasement of World Currencies." It is inflation, but not as we know it. And basically, Warburton was saying that derivatives were either invented or were being used to divert monetary inflation away from real things into paper instruments, and that really just a relatively few billion dollars using derivatives in the futures markets could easily control the major commodities markets, and that he ended his essay by laying out what he called the search for the perfect hedge against monetary debasement. And he came up with things like, I think, farmland and water supplies and things like that. But the prerequisite for the perfect hedge, Warburton wrote, was that it could not have a futures market attached to it, because the futures markets were the instruments of, you know, price suppression and government control. And I think Warburton was the first one, as far as I know, who figured the whole thing out. And that was to, you know, prevent people from seeing how their currency was being debased in order to aggregate power toward the government and away from the public. Now, I don't think the Western investing public is going to pull the plug on this. I don't think people over here are informed enough and smart enough and really have enough initiative to figure it out. I think the plug on this is going to be pulled by
Asia.
Eastern governments. That's right. I mean, yeah. We know Russia knows. We know China knows. If Russia and China know and are even broadcasting it as they've been lately, then other Eastern and Third World powers are, I think, going to be spending their dollar surpluses. Those countries with dollar surpluses are going to, I think, try to hedge themselves. Already are trying to hedge themselves gradually, trading dollars for real things, and U.S. government bonds for real things. Now, I don't think they want this to happen overnight. In fact, I suspected in the last so-called gold and silver correction that it probably had the assistance.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I think they've picked up a lot, particularly in mining.
Oh, yeah, mining. I do too. But I think in this correction that may be ending now, I've suspected that that China may have been assisting in it.
Right.
Because China is not yet fully hedged with its dollar reserves. I suspect right now, even if gold was revalued to a market price, which could be in the many thousands of dollars, China, I suspect, would still lose more from the revaluation because its dollar surplus is still too high. So, even those nations that I think, want to shift out of the dollar and into gold or something else for reasons of political influence around the world. I don't think they're ready for it yet because they've not fully hedged their dollar surpluses. And I think only when they feel fully hedged will they pull the plug.
Now, before we end, Franklin, I want to invite you in to make any comments you have on the discussion tonight.
Just one thing that occurred to me. Chris, to what extent do you think that the gold and silver ETFs were part of a scheme to divert demand away from physical?
I know it sounds conspiratorial, Franklin, but given my dealings with the people involved in those things, given particularly their custodians, Morgan Chase and HSBC, which are very much the agents of the U.S. government and the British government in controlling the gold market, I think you have to assume that the gold and silver ETFs were indeed set up to help the Western central banks control the monetary metals markets, no question, in my mind anyway.
Right, and they've done a sterling job of it, too.
Yeah, you know, look, if they had their way perfectly, you know, gold would, you know, you get a gold or silver coin in a box of Wheaties, you know, it would be, you know, considered, you know, that, you know, useless and that much of a trinket. But, you know, if you can see the glass is half full or half empty, you know, we've gone from about $260 back in 99 when Gatta was formed to $1,600 today in gold, and in silver from maybe $450 to something over $30, and that's a hell of an increase. On the other hand, market prices of gold and silver today would be multiples of those prices. So I suspect they are probably congratulating themselves for restraining the gains in the monetary metals to what they are today.
Sure.
Well, Chris, we're out of time, so if you could describe for us how we keep up with you and the Gatta Wire and Gatta.
Oh, sure. Our internet site is gata.org. We have a irregular daily newsletter called the Gatta Dispatch, which alerts people to news stories and commentaries of particular interest to gold and silver. The Dispatch is by no means any attempt to be a complete reporting about the metals, but things that would be of interest, particularly to people who are concerned about the suppression of gold and silver prices. We send these dispatches out by email to anybody who wants them. All you have to do is go to our internet site. In the right column of our internet site, there's a little window where you can plug your email address in. You can sign up for receiving either every dispatch individually, or we have a daily summary of the dispatches that went out in the last 24 hours. So if you don't want to get your email box crowded with two or three or five or eight dispatches in a day, you can sign up instead for the daily summary, so you get only one dispatch a day. We try to make it easy for people to get off the list. Every dispatch at the bottom contains a mechanism for unsubscribing, and you can also unsubscribe by using that window I was talking about in the right column at gata.org.
And if you're speaking publicly, how do we find out what the
update is? Oh, generally, I will include at the bottom of every Gatta Dispatch the speaking schedule for Gatta's officers. We don't have anything going on in the next few weeks anyway. I'll be at the meeting of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education spring dinner meeting in New York on May 17th. I guess I'm really just moderating part of that. But I think our next real appearance at a conference will be at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference in June. I think it's the 3rd and the 4th. I'll be sending something out about that shortly. There's a couple of conferences in Hong Kong that I'll be speaking at in the middle of June. One is a Standard Chartered conference. Another couple of organizations have come together. I can't remember their names right now, but I'll be putting something about that
up around the globe.
Well, it's a little more wide ranging than I was expecting it to be, but Asia, I suspect, is really the audience we ought to appeal to, because the people over there understand the monetary metals much better, and ironically, the press, I think, is much freer to report about them honestly than the press in the West is.
Well, Chris, it's been a delight to have you on the Solari Report. I thank you very much for joining us.
Kat, thanks for your interest as always. And Franklin, good to hear you too.
Yes, sir. You too.